You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Time for your view from the C-suite here on Classic Business, bringing you closer to the business leaders around the boardroom table, be they CEOs, founders, or CFOs and chairs, and what makes them tick, what keeps them up at night and gets them out of bed every morning and drives them to excel through this unprecedented time that we're living through. Well, my next guest needs very little introduction. She's South Africa's wealthiest woman, a self-made billionaire who fled the penury of Polish communism to establish Signia Asset Management in the country, and she's become something of a political economy crusader on Twitter. Magda Francesca Verzica, welcome to The View, Magda. And I promise not too many questions about your recent estate planning. I had the pleasure of visiting your country of birth, Poland, in June last year. I was a guest along with several property analysts kicking the bricks of EPP, Eco Polska Properties. Mm-hmm. And it really, you know what struck me about your country of birth is it's a superb example of what can be achieved when a country lays outdated ideological shibboleths to rest, embraces modern capitalism and rewards hard work and education. And along with Australia, it was the only country in the world to enjoy uninterrupted GDP growth for the last 28 years. But it wasn't always like that before the 1989 revolution. You were born in, 1970. I don't want to give away your age, but I just have. You grew up in your formative years in Poland. Where exactly did you live, and what do you recall about life under communist rule?
Well, I lived in a very different Poland to what Poland is today. I was actually in Poland in January at the invitation of some think tank and speaking at some conferences and in Warsaw. And, you know, it's a very, very different country to the one I remember. I grew up in an era where, you know, you had the Communist Party rule, which basically meant that education was free, healthcare was free, and employment was guaranteed. Everyone was supposedly on the same level financially. So everyone lived in the same small apartment, ranging in size from 30 to 60 square meters in these kind of prefabricated apartment blocks. And the problem was, and everything was controlled. So the concept of crime was, you know, didn't really exist because, you know, any form of crime was very severely dealt with. There was obviously no freedom of press. And it was a bubble in the sense that they also controlled the media and they controlled any access to information, or the government controlled any access to information about the West. So we were never exposed to the films from United States, for instance. Mm. You know, the TV was merely whatever the Communist Party wanted you to see. And, you know, the problem with that kind of a system was that, you know, idealistically, you know, it sounds a very fair system, and you had an amazing education system in particular, and a fairly strong healthcare system. But the problem is that it's a completely unaffordable system. So eventually all these communist countries, so USSR and then the satellites that existed around us, ran out of money, literally ran out of money. And that is what led to solidarity movement in Poland and eventual fall of communism. Because, you know, the concept that you can employ everyone, the concept that you can provide them with free healthcare, free education, it's a bit of a Lenin-Marx utopia. Mm. But in a practical world, it is not really feasible. And compromises need to be made.
And I think that there are clearly lessons that the ANC could learn from Poland, because in effectively a generation, a country that was ideologically aligned to where so many still in the ruling party find their ideological roots, turned almost 180 degrees towards a more market-based system. And being in Poland last year, just it was remarkable how successful that economy is. One of the fastest growing retail markets in the world, the development that's going on all over the place. You still have those high-rise apartment blocks that throw back to a communist era, a stark reminder. But the Polish people, hardworking, enjoying their freedom and enjoying the fruits of capitalism.
100%. I think, you know, the biggest lesson, and basically what actually helped me a lot when I came to South Africa and speak English, was that very strong educational basis. So genuinely, the focus on education under communism is actually what led to the fact that you had, coming out of communism, you had 98% literacy rate in Poland, very strong kind of mathematical background. But what that system created and what is driving that phenomenal growth, and up until last year, you know, Poland was growing at between 4 to 5% per annum GDP, what is driving all of it and has been driving all of it is entrepreneurship. So literally coming out of the communist system, everyone became an entrepreneur and everyone started setting up small businesses. And what continues right now in Poland is exactly that. That growth is being driven by small to medium-sized enterprises. I don't want to talk about limousine, but a car picked me up at the airport to take me to the hotel. And, you know, the driver was telling me his life story, because he was about the same age as me. And, he said to me, it's amazing to him that given how he grew up and where he is now, you know, he owns a fleet of 10 different taxis and he can afford anything he wants to. And he's thinking of expanding his business in, you know, a couple of different branches. But literally everyone you meet in Poland is an entrepreneur in one way or another. The huge lesson is education and focus on education. And I think this is what South Africa has gotten so wrong.
Yeah, unfortunately, it is almost the apex problem in our country. If you look at all of the studies, the Pearls report that 4 out of 5 children at grade 4 level cannot read for meaning is just a damning stat that sticks in my mind whenever we think about where we have gone wrong, obviously allied to the corruption and the ethical decay of the ruling party. You then obviously fled Poland with your family. You came to South Africa and you have carved out a phenomenal career. You're married with 2 children, but you've been a successful businesswoman at the same time. So I don't know how you managed to balance all of that. While in high school, I believe you worked at a supermarket selling cheese and cold meats. So you've always had an entrepreneurial spirit about you. Would you say you're more of a hunter or a gatherer, Magda?
Probably a little bit of both. We obviously arrived in South Africa with a bit of a layover in a refugee camp in Austria for a year. And we arrived here with absolutely no money. So my parents are medical doctors. They're still alive and living in Cape Town. But we arrived here with $500 in the bank. And, you know, 3 children, grandmother and my parents. And they had to focus on rebuilding their lives. And literally, you know, they had to rebuy every single spoon, every single, you know, cup, plate. So we, you know, growing up, I mean, I was 12, we kind of had to take care of ourselves as kids. And because there wasn't any money, obviously I had to find ways of earning something. So I've always liked nice clothes, even in those days, and couldn't afford any of them. So I got a job at OK Bazaars in Sunnyside in Pretoria and worked at OK Bazaars.
And I think anyone who's ever met you, Magda, I've got to stop you there. Whenever I've met you, you've always been the best dressed person in the room. So that's certainly something that has followed you throughout your career.
Yeah, I can tell you something about this crisis right now that we're living through. The one temptation that has gone completely, and it just talks to the psychology of what everyone in South Africa is going through, I've stopped shopping. You know, I was a very big online shopper. And I haven't bought a single thing in the past 6 weeks.
And that's not just because government hasn't allowed us to use e-commerce in an unfettered way. No. Thank goodness we saw it in about turn on that yesterday.
Yes. No, I think it just talks to the psychology of what we're going to go through. But, you know, we'll get to that. And then, you know, so yes, I worked at OK Bazaars. And then when it came to university, again, there was no money to pay for university, and someone mentioned to me the fact that there's this subject called actuarial science, and life insurance companies were giving out bursaries for actuarial science, and without knowing what it was, and frankly, I have a scant knowledge of actuarial science today, I applied for those bursaries, and I got a couple, and I ended up at UCT studying actuarial science, which, again, I did not know what the subject was. but based on a bursary, which obviously was of huge benefit. And then, you know, just very quickly leapfrogging through it. You know, I started my career at Southern Life. I had to pay off my bursary by working for Southern Life. And I actually managed my very first passive index tracking fund while I was there. Then I moved to Alexander Forbes, and I set up the investment consulting division to retirement funds. And from there, I joined what then was really a startup, Coronation Fund Managers. Stayed with them for 6.5 years, took over running African Harvest Fund Managers, and after that, set up Signia in 2006. So that's a kind of very quick career progression. But, it, you know, none of it was easy, and none of it involved balance. So, you know, I very quickly learned that you can't have balance in life, particularly as a woman, because, you know, a man, I mean, life is easy. You usually expect the wife to take care of the house, of the shopping, of the cooking, of the children, and you just go to work and come back. You know, as a woman, if you want to work, you still have all these other chores and expectations placed on you. So I very quickly, fortunately, with, you know, my husband Simon is a modern age man, or else he's been beaten into submission. But, you know, we shared all tasks equally from the beginning. So I was very careful who I married. And, you know, we made compromises. I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time. You know, I was on the road a lot. I traveled a lot, for instance, with my kids. But what I said to them when they were little, I said to them, you know, I might not spend as much time with you when you are small, but when you are older, I want to be the first person you come to with life problems, work problems, and anything you encounter in life, because I would have had those experiences and you will value my opinion. So I'm sacrificing the time now for time in future.
And that is the art of investing as well, being able to delay gratification almost. But I can understand why you say you're a bit of a hunter and a gatherer, certainly both traits evidenced in your career. I just want to zoom in on the deal when you left Coronation and you became the CEO of African Harvest Group in the early 2000s. You then negotiated the sale of Metalon Corporation's African Harvest Fund Managers, which at the time was, I think, around about a 20 billion rand asset management firm.
35
to Cadiz. But when I saw the name, the first thing I thought of was Mzi Kamalo, because it was one of the first stories I ever worked on with David Gleason. Mzi Kamalo was quite a character. Who could ever forget that Harmony BE deal story? How close were you to Mzi? And do you still keep in contact with him?
Oh, yes. So you know, when I left Coronation, I actually started my first company, which kind of lasted for 6 months, because I started a fund of hedge funds company called IQVest. And certain people followed me from Coronation, worked for me without getting paid. So the stress levels were quite high. And, you know, one day, kind of 6 months into that journey, we had no clients. I was asked to come to lunch by a friend of mine. I invited to lunch. And I went to that lunch and at Weinhaus in Newland. And, you know, in the booth was a friend of mine, as well as a larger gentleman. And as I walked up to the table, he looked at me. He said, "Hi, Magda, I'm Mzi Kamalo. You have a business. I have a business. Let's make a deal." And his business was African Harvest, which he recently acquired from Coronation, interestingly enough. And, you know, in that moment, I knew that I didn't have a business. I just had an office. And some people who were looking at me with big eyes, you know, kind of working for free. And he supposedly had a business. And so, you know, without giving it heck of a lot of thought, I went, okay, let's make a deal. And, you know, we merged the two businesses. I mean, I genuinely didn't have much of a business. It was more of an idea of a business.
Yeah.
And, of course, when I arrived at African Harvest, on the first day, you know, on my desk in my office, there was a white envelope, and it was a due diligence report that Mzi commissioned after he bought African Harvest. And that due diligence report was a horror show of mismanagement, of unpaid taxes, of just, it was a horror show. And when I looked at the sale agreement, which he signs with Coronation. You know, every clause where it should have said the seller indemnifies the buyer from any tax liabilities, from any issues, from the past mismanagement of the company. It read the opposite. It said the buyer indemnified the seller because Mzee never read what he signed. Oh. So he signed this agreement, then commissioned a due diligence, then discovered that he has wasted 300 million rand on a business that was actually in liquidation. So, of course, I phoned Mzee immediately, and I said, Mzee, what the hell? You know, what is this report? And he says to me, Magda, it's not that I didn't tell you the truth. It's just that you really didn't ask the right question.
No, that's typical Mzee Khumalo. It really is. What a fantastic story. So, I mean, the lesson in that is obviously, well, one has to have good deal instincts. You've always got to go through things with a fine tooth comb and do your DD.
You do. And now, you know, in terms of Mzee, I have a great relationship with him. I'll tell you what I've always said about him. He made a billion rand out of the Harmony deal. He was one of the first participants in a BE transaction. And he actually didn't break any rules in making that money. He was just cleverer than the people who drafted the agreement. So, you know, he got the shares, obviously, at a discounted valuation. He wasn't allowed to sell them. There was a lock-in. But there was nothing stopping him from shorting the shares, which is what he did, and how he made his money, which became controversial because, you know, you were supposed to enter into these BE transactions. You weren't supposed to, you know, a couple of years later, walk away with a billion rand.
One could argue it was the creation of a new capitalist class in this country. Some might have looked at the spirit, but certainly it has spawned that. Now, your stint at Coronation certainly set you up, as well as the various deals with African Harvest and others, to establish Signia in the South African market. And I want to come to some of your funds. But firstly, I want to ensure that we get to the major talking point in case we run out of time. And it's obviously our continued approach to one of the strictest lockdowns in the world. And I feel it's bought us time. I'm not going to share with you what I think of the strategy. I'd like to hear your thoughts. What are your thoughts of the decision, firstly, to go into the lockdown as hard as we did, and then the decision by the president on Wednesday to continue with level four for another 2 weeks, considering what we know now?
So, look, I think that the actual decision to go into a hard lockdown, I think the timing of it, with hindsight, and it's, you know, hindsight is perfect science, always. I think that the decision to go into this hard lockdown was premature, but it was premature for one reason, and that is, you know, the idea of lockdowns, apart from, you know, buying time in order to prepare healthcare services, it's also meant to be, you know, a period where you shut down after the infection has started, kind of has taken root. So what you are trying to do is, you know, this concept of flattening the curve. So without lockdowns, you know, the curve would grow exponentially. With a lockdown, the curve grows a bit and then flattens out. Well, in South Africa, the timing of the lockdown was such that we actually never allowed the curve to happen. We went into lockdown before there was any mass transmission of the virus into the broader population, and consequently we, you know, we have not and still are not building up sufficient amount of, you know, the concept of herd immunity, but sufficient number of people who are getting infected and building up antibodies, because that's our only exit strategy in terms of this virus. This virus is here to stay. This is a new disease that is going to be around for a very long period of time. And, you know, we need to develop antibodies to this virus and be allowed to develop those antibodies. Now, you know, we went into lockdown and, of course, hindsight. But we should have stayed in lockdown just for enough time to build up some healthcare capacity. And then we should have opened up the economy, because going into that hard lockdown that we went into and are still under has meant that we have literally killed the economy of this country. Now, a lockdown would always have killed the economic growth. But if you had allowed it to happen later, then, you know, it should ideally be happening at a time when your curve is, of infections is peaking, not right up front. So you've killed the economy. You've killed the small and medium-sized enterprises in this country. You've killed informal employment in this country. People are starving. And at the same time, no infections are happening. So you're not building up immunity across your population. So all we have done is literally visually, instead of flattening the curve, we have pushed out the curve, and we continue to push out the curve. And the moment we reopen, those infections are going to grow exponentially. Now, in the meantime, you know, as we know, South African economy was as fragile as anything, with unemployment rate hovering around 30%. Now it's projected to go to over 50%. You know, we, as it was, best case scenario, we were projecting growth of only just 1% for 2020. Now it's negative 10 to 15. And actually, the point of maintaining this lockdown right now completely escapes me. So I, for whatever reason, you know, firmly believe that the announcement we heard a couple of days ago was going to talk to, we are now unlocking the economy and we are going to either level three or level two. Because we've now bought ourselves time. We've prepared the healthcare system, and President Ramaphosa said all of that. We've prepared the healthcare. We've got 25,000 hospital beds ready. Well, then you should now reopen the economy sufficiently to allow the spread of the virus and the buildup of, and absolutely, when it starts peaking, you can lock it down. But you need to allow people to earn a living, because without that, you know, what is happening is the aims of this lockdown are actually not being achieved. So if you go into the township, people are milling around without face masks. There's no social distancing. We've all seen the pictures of the food queues, which stretch for 5 kilometers, you know, 15 people wide. No social distancing. We have seen old people who are the most vulnerable queuing for SASSA grant distribution. Again, no social distancing whatsoever. So you really have to question what on earth is going on and why we are being, you know, because literally we have killed the economy. And unlocking the economy is going to be a lot more difficult.
And Magda, I've got to interject there because we are running out of time, but I speak to business owners on a daily basis and they are literally right at the end of their runway. Many went into, as you said, into this crisis probably with about 2 months worth of capital to survive at a mom and pop type level, and we just don't have the resources to support them. We don't have the balance sheet of a Federal Reserve or the Bank of England or anything like that, or the ECB. We have to deal with what is ahead of us. So what do we do now? Because we feel like, and I think I share the sentiments here of so many people, that we're living in something of a quasi-dictatorship at the moment. The oversight role of Parliament seems to have been usurped by the Command Council, or is it Cabinet? Who's making the rules or decisions right now? And everyone feels a little powerless.
Well, I think we're all feeling powerless because, you know, you've got this concept of this National Command Council, which now has turned out to be an illegitimate body. So there's a lot of revisionist history happening. It's now Cabinet. It's not really a National Command Council. And there's still no parliamentary oversight over any of the regulations that are being issued. But, you know, I did early on in all of this took legal advice. I wanted to know what my legal rights are, anyone's legal rights are in terms of the Constitution. And, you know, I went to the best constitutional tilt in South Africa. And, you know, what I was told at the time was that, which was, you know, a couple of weeks ago, when I started seeing those queues of hungry people. And by the way, I've got absolutely no vested interest personally, because one, I'm immunocompromised. So I'm in a high risk group personally. My parents are in their 80s, so they're in a high risk group. Signia is an essential service. So, you know, we're not that affected. We are very fortunate not to be that affected by what's happening. But I went to it purely from a perspective of I cannot witness, you know, people standing in queues, queuing for food. That I have never experienced in this country before. And the advice I was given was that at the end of the day, courts have very limited powers. And provided government can justify, government or National Command Council or the Cabinet these days, provided that they can justify each and every decision on the basis of human life. So if we do this, people die. No court will rule against the government, which is, I think, why BET withdrew its case on tobacco, because, you know, they can actually point to tangible debt, whereas everything else is in the sphere of economics, hunger, poverty, whereas, you know, the government can say 120 people have died. And I was told no judge in this country will rule against the government. You know, so with that framework in mind, you know, I together with everybody else, now feel that we are living in a dictatorship, that rules are arbitrary, as we have seen, and are being arbitrarily made. Every single rule, you know, you do get a, you know, kind of impression that rules are made by individual ministers, and then when they come under, off the bat, you know, they just make this stuff up on the spot. And then when questioned, it becomes an issue of, no, it was a collective decision. But there are no minutes of any meeting that decided that cigarettes, for instance, should be banned. So there's certain randomness to what is happening. I've also seen recommendations made by various different bodies to government, all talking to unlocking the economy a lot more than what has happened. And that's why I fully expected 2 or 3 days ago for Ramaphosa to announce unlocking of the economy. And he didn't. He actually didn't. I think, you know, that was the biggest shock to the system, because a lot of businesses don't have any more runway. You know, the small and medium-sized enterprises are closed for all intents and purposes. And the country is bankrupt. And the, by the way, the 500 billion stimulus measure, you know that's an optical illusion. There is no 500 billion. We don't have 500 billion.
It's 200 billion underwritten by the Treasury to allow the banks to extend money. There's probably exactly. 130 billion in expenditure cuts. And, less than 100 billion that we're borrowing from international financial 95? Institutions. Yeah.
95, if we can, and we're still not there, World Bank and IMF, and only because in a sense more would come with associated conditions, such as restructuring of the public service, which cannot happen, given, you know, the unionized space that we're moving into.
Yeah.
So they can only borrow. Thank goodness. Actually, I kind of go, thank God, because they are borrowing in dollars. So if you start borrowing in dollars, one of South Africa's saving graces has been that we've always borrowed in rand and not in foreign currency. These borrowings come in dollars. So if the rand depreciates further, all of a sudden your debt of 95 billion can become 200 billion. But so thank goodness there is a cap on what we are able to borrow. And then, you know, the rest of it is, you know, yes, reprioritization of budgetary expenditure. But when you are losing 250 billion in taxes, there's no more reprioritization. That money has evaporated already.
There's
a bigger hole.
That is the bottom line. Magda, unfortunately, we're going to have to end it there. We have run out of time, but it has been a great pleasure sharing your insights and your unconstrained view from the C-suite here on Classic Business. Take care.